the theme of the conference is the unexpected. And we're specifically interested in unexpected discoveries in science. Unexpected discoveries or developments in history will be part of what we discuss as well. So we've got a lot of interesting individual sessions on unexpected findings, developments, etc. But before we get into that, we're going to have a session on the role of consensus in sometimes suppressing unexpected discoveries. And we've got a really terrific first speaker on this, Steve Fuller. He's an alum of these meetings. He was here, I think, 2 years ago. We were also in Italy. And he's a philosopher of science. He did his PhD at the University of Pittsburgh, which is one of the renowned programs in that discipline. He had tenure at Pitt before he came to the UK, where he had a position at Durham. And now he's a chair of social epistemology at University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. And this issue of the relationship between consensus and unexpected discoveries and findings in science is actually one of the themes of his very first book in social epistemology. And so for him, it's kind of an opportunity to come back to some of those early ideas that he developed and reflect for us in a way that I think will frame a lot of our discussions in the conference. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and we're absolutely
Well, thank you. Thank you. First of all, I'm really pleased to be here because I think I see that this is a group of people who are potentially change makers in various kinds of ways. I have to also say I have to thank David Berlinski for suggesting this kind of topic to me. And I'm not sure whether, in fact, David or any of you know what Steve was just alluding to, namely that this issue about the relationship between consensus and the unexpected is actually something that goes to my earliest work in social epistemology. Okay, and so social epistemology basically is about trying to understand the social foundations for knowledge production, and it has a kind of normative orientation, and that's why it's called epistemology, right? In the sense that, you know, not only do we want to know how knowledge is actually organized, but what we want to also understand is how it should be organized, okay? And this has always been kind of my long-standing concern, and the field occupies a kind of space, generally speaking, between philosophy and the social sciences, okay? Now, in this first book of mine, Social Epistemology, I have a chapter in the middle of it. In fact, it's the only chapter of that book that has anything to do with my PhD, which I won't talk about here. But you know, I'm not someone who actually published his PhD as a book. But one chapter of it actually made it into this first book of mine, and it has to do with the elusive nature of consensus in science. There's a chapter in that book with that title. Okay, and this actually has to do with the way in which consensus arises as an issue within the philosophy of science, and again, keeping in mind my age and so forth, right, we're talking about in the 1970s and 80s when this kind of topic was really very hot within the philosophy of science. I mean, I think consensus as an issue in science is a more generally interesting topic, but within the philosophy of science it was actually discussed very heatedly in the 1970s and 80s, largely in the back of the work of Thomas Kuhn. Okay, because there's a sense in which, one way of reading Thomas Kuhn's work was that there's a sense in which what counts as scientific validity is basically what scientists agree upon, right? And so, as it were, you have a kind of rolling consensus through paradigm after paradigm. And the thing that was kind of interesting about Kuhn's account, and this is where we start to get kind of the first sense in which consensus relates to the unexpected, is what's Kuhn's account of how consensus forms in science? Okay, so let's say we start with the idea that science is determined by what scientists think at a given point, based on the evidence, reason, whatever. And then the question becomes, okay, how do they decide to move from one paradigm to another, which is kind of the interesting question, given that we sort of normally regard science as an enterprise that's progressive with regard to knowledge. And his answer is actually to refer back to this kind of remark that the physicist Max Planck makes in his autobiography, where he talks about the way you get major scientific change is not by persuading anyone, but just by generations changing. Right? So generational change, as it were, is the primary motor, of course, but of course that is a kind of a, you might say, unexpected from the standpoint of the way in which science actually frames its disagreements and its conflicts, right, that's an unexpected feature, you might say, of the way in which scientific change occurs. Because you sort of would have expected an answer that would be couched in terms of the scientific method and following scientific reason, and that, you know, if you make this kind of an argument, people will believe this and they'll change their mind and so forth. But no, rather what you need are just new people entering the field. Right, and this is often called the Planck effect within the history of science. Now, philosophers of science were very disturbed by this, okay, because it sort of suggested, what, you mean scientific change is just irrational, and each of these consensuses are just being, you know, it's a kind of a byproduct of something that happens sort of biologically? I mean, it's sort of like one way you could read this, right? In a sense, you could see this as kind of a triumph for evolutionary epistemology, right, that scientific change is a byproduct of it. And so what you end up getting, you know, across the 1980s, and this is the period when I start entering into the field and I start writing about this stuff, that people start to say, no, 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 really, Planck is overstating the point. In fact, that there are, you know, decisive kinds of arguments that make the difference when people start moving from one sort of consensus to another. Okay? But let's step back for a minute and just get a sense of what is motivating the sort of view that Kuhn is putting forward. And I think the idea here is that Kuhn and going back to Planck, I think all of these guys realize that there's a sense in which if you're trained in the scientific method and so forth, that you know how to, you know, you know how to assess arguments, you know how to weigh evidence, you know how to do that kind of stuff. But then there's this kind of additional question about your investment in going down a particular way. Because, of course, I think one of the things that all scientists appreciate, just as a general point, and is certainly something that philosophers of science have been emphasizing over the past half century, if not more, is the fact that even if we have a kind of common understanding of a body of data, a body of knowledge on which we're basing our science, nevertheless, it is an open question what are the theoretical horizons that are open for taking that body of knowledge forward into new directions. Right? And in the philosophy of science, we talk about this as the underdetermination of theory by data. This is a term that comes from Quine, the logician Quine. It goes back to an idea of Pierre Duhem in the beginning of the 20th century. And so what this means then is that everybody can be weighing the evidence and see, you know, and agreeing on that at a certain kind of basic empirical level. But the interesting question is, where do you take it forward? Where do you go with this? And this is where the issue of the amount of investment you have in going in a certain direction makes a difference. Okay? And of course, people who've spent their whole career pursuing something within a certain kind of theoretical horizon, right, will tend to want to keep on going that way and say, look, you know, we've done all this stuff already. You know, it's paid off certainly for me personally. I've managed to get my stuff published, right? And so why shouldn't we have everybody else do this? Right, whereas other people who are equally knowledgeable about the same body of data, right, they may say, well, I don't know. I mean, there are these other theories out there. They may not be, you know, they may not be so well developed. We may not, you know, they may not be so well articulated, but they do offer interesting prospects of getting us to look into things that your theory is not going to let us look into. And so, in a sense, they don't feel so motivated to actually continue with the old paradigm. And this is where the generational shift thing does matter from the standpoint of how you weigh the relative significance of the past with as a guide to what the future should be. Okay? And I think that's a really important point here about, you might say, the cognitive significance of generational change. Right? It sort of changes your epistemic investments. Okay? And so this is, I think, so in a sense, when a lot of the philosophers in the 1970s and 80s were sort of criticizing Kuhn for not having a sufficiently rationalistic account, right? I think it was largely because the philosophers were kind of limited in their conception of rationality. And they didn't actually take into account this kind of temporal dimension, you might say, about investment, you know, and you know. So, for example, if you're a young person entering the field, you don't feel quite the same burden, in a way, as you do if you're someone who's already seen a certain kind of theory pay off for you. Okay, and so that's kind of an important point. The problem, of course, is with the way in which the scientific establishment is organized, this kind of initial instinct is quashed. Right? And here I want to say something about the peer review process in science as it normally operates. Because here I think, you know, let's think a little bit about how this peer review process came into being. The peer review process, which is often seen as kind of the empirical indicator of what consensus is in a field, actually originated not so much as an epistemic marker in that sense, but rather as a kind of civilizing device. Okay? So in other words, if we go back to the 17th century and we look at the proceedings of the Royal Society, you know, or the Académie de France, you know, I mean, all of these kind of early scientific societies, right, the way that the transaction of information that was going on in this period was very much through correspondence. Okay, there weren't journals in the sense that we understand now, and so the editors, you know, of these academies who got all the correspondence and then distributed them throughout to everybody else, were concerned with the issue of the civility of the way in which people were addressing each other, and especially in the 17th century, this was kind of a big deal because, as you know, the sort of people who were making frontline scientific discoveries were very much typically religiously dissenting, heretical kind of people, and so they were making all kinds of claims and counterclaims about what they suspect is kind of lying behind why someone sees this in a certain way, etc., etc. Right? I mean, this is the great period of the wars of religion in Europe, right? In the aftermath of the Protestant Reformation, and so one of the things that organizations like the Royal Society are trying to do is to kind of, you know, quiet things down, right? Civilize people, and as a result, come up with a way in which people can deal with each other, you know, without aggravating each other, and so forth. And so part of what the editors did was to actually edit out all of the religious insults and so forth that would be otherwise there. Okay? And so what you start to get through this process is a kind of, streamlining of scientific communication. Right, which then gives you a kind of lingua franca within which then, if you're going to be dealing in science, this is how you deal with it. You bring up these issues and not these issues, right? And the idea, you know, if you recall the charter of the Royal Society, right, the idea here is that, you know, we leave politics, rhetorics, and morals at the door, and we just deal with the stuff that we can measure and we can quantify and all the rest, and we can see, right? And that is the kind of part. So the initial idea of this peer review process was a civilizing process. It was also a self-protective mechanism as well, because if it looked like that these guys who were doing science were these kind of radical, crazy guys, right, the state would not want to have anything to do with it. And so the point was, the Royal Society got a corporate charter that allowed it autonomy as an institution. And so that required that it had some means of regulating itself. And that means, you know, you have to dampen down, you know, all of that kind of religious motivation that was in fact very much behind the science that was being produced in that period. Okay? So now, that was what peer review was originally about. It was about that. Okay? Now then, over time, of course, and not too long afterwards, right, peer review sort of became what I would call the relatively what I would regard as innocuous process that it occupies today, which is that peer review is a kind of quality control thing, right? So you check whether people get stuff right or wrong, because in a sense the journal or the discipline is taking corporate responsibility for the knowledge that is produced this way. Okay? So then the idea here is that, you know, you want to get rid of, you know, if people do things that are wrong and so forth, you know, so you're sort of imagining, well, if we publish this piece, we're going to have to stand behind it. I'm going to have to stand behind it. Can I stand behind this piece? Okay, and so issues of method become very important under those circumstances. And from my standpoint, that's a perfectly reasonable way of using peer review. Okay, I mean, now that context of using peer review is one where people have already published stuff. I mean, in other words, no, that they've already done research on stuff, they've written it up, and now you're sort of considering it at the final stage, and that's the place where the peer review operates. And then it's determined whether it gets allowed to be licensed by the organization that's peer reviewing it. That's kind of the model, and that's okay. The problem arises when peer review gets used as a basis for funding. Right? In other words, where peer review gets brought from the point of the end point of research, where it's a kind of quality control check, to sort of the initial point of research, where we're making decisions about what's worth pursuing. Right? That's where peer review becomes a problem. Because at that point then, you're really being asked to make a different kind of decision, but you're still using the same old criteria to decide it. Right? So in other words, so the point here is that when you're talking about what sort of research to fund, right, the research hasn't yet been funded, okay? And so you have to think about, you have to ask a different kind of question. Where do you want to see this field going? How do you want to see this field go? Okay? Now, the interesting thing, of course, is if you look at the history of funding of research, right, most of which has been done by private agencies until after World War II, I think, you know, as a general statement, that's true, that the private agencies that have funded research have tended not to go to the peer review process, right? They tend to, in fact, I mean, the Rockefeller Foundation is a sort of great case in point, where you've got some guy, Warren Weaver, right, who was the head of the Natural Science Division of the Rockefeller Foundation during its crucial period in the 20th century, and he's the guy of Shannon Weaver, information theory fame, right? He's a mathematician, right, but he's a kind of generally knowledgeable sort of guy, and you trust his judgment, right? And this guy then starts scouting around, traveling around to various universities and so forth, and in the context of, 20th century America in particular, but also in Europe, in Germany, in England, places like this, the idea is to find people who have very interesting ideas that aren't able to pursue them because they're usually kind of burdened by teaching obligations, as universities typically were, right, until after World War II, were typically teaching-oriented institutions, and research was something you did on the side. Okay, so guys like Warren Weaver were effectively connoisseurs, you might say. Connoisseurs of scientific talent. And they sort of went around and they started, you know, inviting people to put in bids for various things. And then, Rockefeller Foundation may or may not accept these things. But the point is that this is the way they did it. It was not peer review. Okay? The idea that funding should be decided on a peer review level, I think, was really very strongly institutionalized with the National Science Foundation in the United States after World War II. Okay? And here I think there's a whole lot of mixed motives going on here. Because one of the presuppositions, I think, of the private funding of scientific research was that scientists themselves kind of know, especially if they're sort of smart in some way, what's the best way for science to go. Okay, and that in a sense, you want to sort of let them decide the matter. They're, as it were, they're the best kind of guarantors of what the future of science should be. I think one of the problems that happens when you get into the public funding realm that you see after the end of the Second World War is that the National Science Foundation, the U.S. government generally, and all the other governments that have emulated this, because this has been a model that's been reproduced throughout the world, basically start to say, well, you know, we really like the quality control aspect of peer review, so that's really quite important. And so we're going to sort of extend that indefinitely, and when it comes to what the point of science should be or what direction science should go into, that will be dealt with by a different department of the government. Right? So in other words, the funding kind of gets collapsed into the self-policing mechanism. Right, and so there's an incentive, because now money's involved, there's an incentive provided for scientists to be unduly conservative with regard to the judgments they make of each other. Okay? Because in fact, all of the normative side, you know, where science should go, is being determined outside. Okay? I don't think this was planned to be that way. To be honest, I don't think it was planned to be that way, but I think this is kind of the unintended consequence, unexpected, if you will, of this kind of arrangement that's taken place with public funding. And this is why, where you see all the complaints arising with regard to science, you know, not, you know, where the peer review process breaks down, where, you know, you get scientists complaining en masse that science is not being allowed to go in very interesting directions, it's usually in a public funding setting, right? So I do think that there's a real kind of institutional issue there that continues to this day. It makes this sort of matter very difficult, and you know, this is why I think, in a sense, now historically, again, if you look at this in the long term, the idea that the public is funding science in this kind of way is a relatively limited phenomenon. It's a kind of end of Cold War thing, end of World War II thing, rather, primarily a Cold War thing, which over time has been gradually dissolving, right, you know, in light of the various retreats the state has made over the last 20 years, let's say, since the end of the Cold War. And so I don't know, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know how sustainable that NSF model is. I would seem to think that it's kind of on its way out. But then this then brings up the issue of, you know, okay, now this means that we're going to have to talk again about the private funding of science in a very serious sort of fashion. And this is why in my own thinking, you know, I've actually encouraged people to look into the Rockefeller Foundation, for example, which I think was a very smart organization. Even though it got a lot of, you know, I mean, it's not a very popular, I can tell you right now, it's often seen as kind of the Antichrist within history and philosophy of science community, but you know, because it's quite clear, I mean, one of the things that's very clear about the Rockefeller Foundation is they had a lot of influence. And in fact, if I had to point to one entity that directed the course of 20th century science, especially if we think of it as heading in the direction toward molecular biology and all the things that have come from that, it's the Rockefeller Foundation, okay? Nothing else. The Rockefeller, but most influential single entity. Okay, and this is because they were kind of doing things on this, you know, selecting talent and testing things out and all that. And they sort of bypassed the peer review process at the level of the initial commissioning of the research. Okay, so I do think that this is kind of a model, you know, in terms of the 21st century that we're going to have to revisit in some way and some clever kind of way. Because there are a lot of issues, actually, you know, that are sort of on the table that make the pursuit of very novel scientific research difficult these days in a way it wasn't the case in the 20th century. Okay, and so one needs clever ways of getting around this. But the point is, I think this is the kind of thing on the agenda. How much more time do I have, would you say?
10 minutes or so.
10 minutes or so, okay. There's so many issues. There's so many aspects of this issue that could be discussed. But I do think one thing that, you know, in terms of when we talk about consensus, because this is the word that gets used a lot, I think one needs to be clear about the difficulty of actually nailing down what we're talking about, right? Because insofar as consensus is being used as a kind of validation concept, right? In other words, if we have the consensus of the scientific community, it is therefore true, right? What are we referring to exactly, okay? And here I think, you know, we can draw lots of distinctions. One idea of consensus, and this is an idea that I think should not be underestimated as in fact operating as consensus, is the kind of idea that you see in what, I don't know, some of you who are in political theory maybe know about the political philosopher Benjamin Barber. Some of you may have heard, American political philosopher, who in one of his books in the 1980s talks about interpretive democracy. Okay, interpretive democracy. And interpretive democracy is what he claims, I mean, I'm not having experience, but the idea that in certain legislatures, the way in which you decide whether or not a motion carries is just through lack of disagreement. Right? So if no one complains, it passes. So it's interpretive democracy, right? Because if someone had a disagreement, they would have said something. Okay? And I actually do think that, in fact, in science, it's mostly like that. It's at that kind of basic, kind of epistemically problematic level, right? Because it's not like everybody, as it were, has been forced to say what they really think, to what extent and to what degree, but rather it's whether you let it pass. And you can let things pass for all kinds of reasons. For example, it doesn't bother me in my day-to-day research. So why should I worry about it? So if somebody has a strong view about something and it doesn't affect me directly, let's go. Right? This is how we tolerate each other. Right, so interpretive democracy, right? It's an interesting concept. But I think this actually does apply to a large extent in science. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's very difficult. For example, you know, if we go to, you know, this the very controversial issues surrounding things like, you know, Darwinism and so forth, it's actually very hard to figure out what consensus is. So I'll give you an example. In 2006, so this was shortly after what I guess I would see as kind of the peak of all of the craziness surrounding the intelligent design controversy. There was a document that was endorsed by the so-called Inter-Academy Panel, which is all the academies of science throughout the world, 70 of them, so you got to imagine 70 countries signing up to this, condemning creationism, right? And this thing, when it came out, was advertised very loudly in the press as being, showing how all of science is behind evolution. Now the problem is, read the document. What is it these guys agreed on? Okay? And it ends up that what they agreed on was that they didn't like young earth creationism. They didn't like that. And they were making a big noise about the fossil record and all the usual things that one brings up against young earth creationism. But what you didn't see was a discussion of natural selection or any of the principles that one might think of as driving evolution. There was no commitment to any particular principle of evolution on this. It was just a kind of statement of a commitment to evolution. Now, my guess is the reason why the document is framed this way is because those 70 guys were actually in the room arguing with each other. And so as a result, when it actually came down to a consensus where you're actually forcing everybody to agree on a joint statement, you end up getting this very kind of bland, you know, kind of victimization of the easy target. Okay? And this is the great consensus that exists. It's at that level when you actually get the people in the room to agree. Okay? And so... Now, what I think is very valuable about looking at that sort of document, which obviously is a political document, but at the same time, it's a document that sort of takes in a very literal kind of way what consensus is supposed to be about. Right? And if there's supposed to be this great consensus in science, right, that is kind of, you know, driving the whole process and so forth, you know, what is, you know, at what level of depth or superficiality does it exist? And I think this document suggests it's relatively superficial. Okay? I mean, I think you would get a lot more precise statements if what they were talking about was very specific kinds of empirical things. Then those 70 academies could agree much more easily on those matters. But when we're talking about the larger explanatory frameworks within which science conducts its business, then the only agreement you're going to get is going to be in terms of pretty vague generalities that if you took them literally could not be used as a basis for research. Right? It's merely at an ideological level. Okay? And I think that's a very telling... And my point here is that this phenomenon is not unique to the controversies over Darwinism and intelligent design and things like this, but I would say this is kind of normal for science. Right, so in other words, the element of consensus that one is talking about, you know, whenever one talks about scientific consensus, is in fact relatively superficial, because generally speaking, when it comes to the sort of big, sort of explanatory, theoretical questions of science, scientists can remain pretty open-minded on a day-to-day basis. They don't have to join a political party or an ideology in order to do their business on a day-to-day basis. Okay, so it's not surprising that when you start talking about these larger theoretical things, the level of consensus is very vague and superficial, but if you were to talk about the more empirical things, you'd get a lot more resolution. Okay? So I do think that this is not surprising. This is to be expected in a way. And I think that the unfortunate thing is how this is in fact misunderstood and misrepresented, this fact. That in fact, science normally, even when it's funded publicly, actually exists with an enormous amount, right, of open-mindedness and disagreement and, you know, with regard to the largest questions. It's just too bad that when we start to get into the public level, that there is a kind of constraint on resources to allow those ideas, as it were, to be pursued. So in a sense, people feel that they have to just be focusing on the narrowly empirical in order to get themselves published and to get their careers advanced. Okay, and this is the great tragedy of science in the time in which we live. Okay? Now finally, I'll end on this point. One of the things that, in terms of how we learn from history in all this, I think it's very important. And I think there, very often when people want to defend the idea that consensus in the strong sense, not in this weak sense that actually exists, but in some sort of epistemically interesting strong sense, where everybody agrees on the same theories for the same reasons, etc., right? They say, well, look, we everybody's believed this in the past, and now this guy's proposing this whole new way of seeing things. Right? It's almost like the problem of induction in philosophy, right? Where in a sense we've been holding these views for so long and they've worked so well, why should we move to something new? Okay? Now I think, in a sense, the past does have a lot to teach us, but it's not that, okay? Because that's too narrow a time horizon within which to allow the past to teach you anything. Instead, what you should do is to actually look at the whole history. Right? You should learn from the past as a whole, more holistic manner, and you should realize that one of the things that is very clear is that in terms of the aspects of science that change most quickly, it is at the larger theoretical level. Okay? I mean, one of the things when I was a student, in the very beginning, back in the 1970s, there was this idea put forward by Hilary Putnam, the philosopher at Harvard, which was what he called the pessimistic meta-induction, namely that based on the history of science, any large scientific theory that we currently believe is probably going to be false, because 100 years ago we didn't believe any of those theories. We believed something totally different at the large scale level. This is not the, of course, the empirical stuff to a large extent may remain true. Okay? I mean, it's not saying that we live in a radically different world, but the aspect of our scientific universe that changes most radically over time is, in fact, at the very top level. Okay? And that's the pessimistic meta-induction. So in other words, you should expect change, right? If you're really thinking about doing a proper science policy for the future, you should be banking on change in the long term, because that's always the way it's been. Okay? And I think if you operate with that kind of time horizon, right, which was quite clear what the Rockefeller Foundation was up to and so forth, right? They had very kind of long time horizons in terms of changing the human condition, changing human beings, all the rest of it. That then I think you get a better sense in which the way in which the past can provide a kind of guide to the future of science that in a way is open to newness, open to the fact that things are bound to change. What we learn from the past is that things are bound to change, right? Rather than just staying in this kind of stultifying consensus-mindedness that I'm afraid dominates the scientific establishment today. And so I'll stop there. Okay?
Stimulating.
Thank you.
Talk, and I wonder if the number of the talks, I think it might be helpful just to make a couple.